Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Cyber Work with InfoSec podcast. Each week, I sit down with a different industry thought leader and we discuss the latest cybersecurity trends, how those trends are affecting the work of InfoSec professionals, while offering tips for those trying to break in or move up the ladder in the cybersecurity industry. Kelly Shortridge is the VP of Product Strategy at Capsule 8 and has been on the move for the last few months. Her presentation at this year's Black Hat was titled Controlled Chaos, the Inevitable Marriage of DevOps and Security. She also presented to Air is Human, the Complexity of Security Failures at Hacktivity. She spends her days immersed in the mindsets and procedural successes and failures of the information security industry, and we're thrilled to have her as a guest on today's podcast to talk about some of these reports. Kelly Shortridge is the Vice President of Product Strategy at Capsule 8. Kelly is known for research into the application of behavioral economics to information security and has spoken at conferences internationally, including Black Hat USA, Velocity, OutCert, Hacktivity, Troopers, and Zero Nights. Previously, Kelly served in product roles at Security Scorecards and BAE Systems after co-founding Iperlane, a security startup that was acquired. Kelly began her career as an investment banker analyst at Tenio, covering the data security and analytics sectors. Kelly, thank you for being here today, and I apologize if I beef the any of those pronunciation of any of those companies.
It was perfect, and thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Okay, well, thank you so much for being here. To start at the very beginning, we'll ask you what we ask everyone: how did you first get started in computers and security? So we mentioned that you started, you know, with a finance background. What drew you over to the tech and security sector, and when did that happen?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, when did I come over to the dark side? So I did start my career as an investment banking analyst, specifically working on M&A as well as capital raising assignments. And only a few months into my role at Teneo, I was tasked with, you know, getting smart on the InfoSec industry. Since there was tons of deal activity growing. This was back in, you know, the 2012 timeframe. And it really only ballooned over the next few years. So I covered information security from the investment banking lens for about 2.5 years before deciding to, you know, kind of YOLO and found a security startup.
Wow. Okay. So they basically sowed the seeds of you leaving the company by asking you to do something that they thought was, you know, maybe a temporary thing. Look at the security thing, and then you're like, okay, I'm out of here.
Exactly. Yes. My kind of cognitive spark really lit up when I would study information security stuff. And it was in some ways a natural fit given what I had studied in undergrad. And also I always kind of had a predilection for tech anyway.
Okay. What did you study in undergrad that connected it to it?
Yeah. So I actually come from a liberal arts background. Okay. And I studied economics, particularly anything regarding behavioral economics. I've been into behavioral economics since I was, 10 or 11 years old.
Can you sort of unpack what that is for our listeners?
Sure. So traditional economics assumes like rational actors and all of this theory, where behavioral economics does have some theory, but it's generally grounded in experimentation. So looking at how people actually behave, not just how we think they're going to behave, assuming certain kind of principles of rationality.
Oh, okay. So yeah, I can definitely see where that would prepare you well for, you know, people acting possibly irrationally in security sector and online.
Exactly.
So what are some of the highlights of your security career? What are some of the jumps that you made in terms of experiences or knowledge or research or job changes that, you know, got you from, you know, from here to there? You said you started a startup pretty quickly there. So where did you sort of get the, you know, the wherewithal and all that for that along the way?
That's a good question. As I mentioned, coming from a liberal arts background, it was a pretty massive knowledge leap to go from finance and economics over to information security, because really I was only technical in the sense that I knew how to build websites and I knew how to build gaming computers, but I didn't really understand, you know, systems or infrastructure or anything like that. So before I even switched away from finance, like I said, it was pretty obvious to me that there were tons of cognitive biases in InfoSec, and they were manifesting in ways that made the market pretty efficient, which meant that the problem area was really interesting to me. And it really led to the question in my mind of, okay, how do we do all of this better? Because clearly there's probably a more efficient way for us to be kind of architecting security strategy and certainly like the solutions that we have in place. So my early research was really around kind of those cognitive biases and behavioral economics in information security. Next was the, okay, how can we do it better, which led to some of my research on resilience. And during that research, what I realized is that resilience as a topic was gaining a lot more traction on the kind of, well, at the time it wasn't called SRE, but kind of the DevOps, ops, you know, infrastructure operations side. They were already making strides and InfoSec hadn't really been paying attention. So that ultimately led me to then look at kind of the unification of DevOps and InfoSec. And during that period of time, I think what I keep coming back to is InfoSec's fundamental problem is this misalignment of incentives. And I think a huge part of that is that the people who are building systems are responsible for securing them, which just creates all sorts of kind of like moral hazard issues. And because the DevOps movement is about aligning responsibility and accountability, it kind of felt like, okay, maybe we should start considering some of these principles in information security as well. And that's where a lot of my research is today.
Okay. So I think that's worth noting or sort of stretching out for our listeners here is that, you know, you didn't just study security to study security or because you wanted to do security. Like you started from certain assumptions and certain sort of questions and you learned based on, I need the answer to these specific questions and sort of learn that way. So I think that's an interesting strategy that I don't think we hear very often on the show.
I think I personally wish more people did that, really going back to what is the actual problem space? What are the assumptions that maybe we're taking for granted that have always been there and maybe we should course correct a little bit? I wish people were a little more critical about the status quo in the industry.
Yeah, and also the fact that you were already sort of in security and then also studying, you know, to answer these certain questions about security, you know, I think there's another sort of not fallacy, but sort of, you know, issue that early students have is that they figure once I've learned all the stuff, then I can sort of like make my entrance into the security world. Whereas, you know, it might be good to, you know, start in there in some capacity, any capacity, and then sort of learn and sort of, you know, as Ray Bradbury said, build your wings on the way down.
Definitely. I agree with that.
So what do you do as VP of product strategy for Capsulate? What does your average day look like in terms of projects, hours, expectations from clients?
Yeah, so my goal, so it's definitely a kind of nebulous title, but really my goal at Capsulate is to ensure that our product provides the best visibility in production for Linux production systems, basically making sure that the security teams are happy because they have the detection coverage they want, that ops teams are also happy because we aren't interfering with their production performance. So to do so, I really have to deeply understand the needs of both communities. Obviously, the security community I've been studying for a while. And I think this kind of heartbeat of the market and understanding that informs where we need to enhance the product, what opportunities we should pursue, and how we should ultimately communicate the value to our customers. So as might be obvious from that sort of description, there's really no average day for me, other than I'll probably have bacon at some point and then some collagen in it.
You heard it here first. Bacon runs the security industry.
It's true, yeah. So some weeks I'm prepping for keynotes like I was before Velocity and Hacktivity last month, prepping for podcasts and webinars. But some weeks I'm labor focused on like product roadmap and strategy, or I'm writing blog post requirements documents, or helping out with some sort of prioritization decision.
Okay. So do you feel you're kind of on the clock like all day long? Do you sort of keep regular hours? Do you have sort of things that are keeping you up at 2 a.m. that you have to deal with and things like that?
No, I'm almost always sleeping very soundly at 2 a.m. luckily. Okay. I at least get 8 hours a night. Sometimes it's 9. I think sleep is important. And there's just so much research that people make really terrible decisions when they're sleep deprived. And probably if you're helping with product strategy, you should make good decisions. So I definitely think it's important to try to maintain some sort of separation between work and home life, though most of my home life is also more like personal work, whether it's like research or my own blog posts on my personal blog. So I'm definitely not going to argue I'm perfect at separating out the two. Sure. But I would say that I've definitely learned the hard way that if you are thinking about it 24/7 and you make it too much of a core component of kind of your fulfillment in life, you're going to probably err on the side of taking too many risks, being just way too nervous about everything you do. And again, that diminishes decision making. So kind of having, it's almost like tricking my brain into being like, okay, you have to have a healthy kind of balance here. Otherwise you're not actually going to make decisions that are going to fulfill you in the long run.
Yeah. We've had such a spectrum of guests on here who, you know, some are very compartmentalized and others. Yeah. It's, you know, this thing's bothering me at 2 a.m. This thing's at 4. I'm up at 5 and wow. If you can do that, I guess, but that's not that I can't do that either. But
I just don't think it's really sustainable.
No, I know. It's a different lifestyle for sure. So, so one of the topics I wanted to ask you today about is your presentation at this year's Black Hat Convention, which was titled Controlled Chaos, the Inevitable Marriage of DevOps and Security. So first of all, can you tell me some about the main points of the presentation?
Definitely. Yeah, there are a few main points, but I think it goes back a little bit to what I said earlier. And one of the core points is that we're going to keep having conflict and inefficiency if we don't unify responsibility and accountability. So for example, in DevOps, it used to be that the developers would just throw all the performance issues over the wall to operations. Operations would be super frustrated because, you know, they didn't build the systems, why did they have to clean it up? And there was really little incentive for developers actually to build performance systems. So developers were responsible, but they weren't held accountable.
Yeah.
So I think, again, what's powerful about DevOps is it's this shared responsibility by design, which is important. And our argument in the talk is that security similarly needs to undergo a shift. I don't think you can keep having accountability and responsibility be siloed and reside among separate teams and organizations, because it's going to lead to this conflict and inefficiency. So security teams, I think most people don't want to be stuck fixing issues in systems they didn't build, right? And developers also are actually missing that feedback loop in order to build more secure systems. They don't see all of those security issues, so they don't realize kind of what headaches they're causing all the time. So to close that feedback loop, realign incentives, you really have to unify that and start having the developers be held accountable. And one of the ways that I at least am working on right now and fleshing out a little further is kind of an embedded SME, a subject matter expert model among security teams. But for this talk at Black Hat, another key point was the DIE model, which was pioneered by Sunil Yu, basically allowing for a way to align DevOps priorities to InfoSec. And I think a core point of the talk was really that DevOps goals aren't that dissimilar from security. We're just not thinking about it in the right way. So DIE stands for distributed, immutable, and ephemeral, and that corresponds to different qualities of infrastructure that actually have a lot of overlooked security benefits actually by design. So for example, an immutable system is one where you have a standardized image and that's used to rebuild things. You don't actually manually configure or edit the resource in any way. So what it means is you can create a rule disallowing SSH access to systems, which obviously makes it way harder for attackers to conduct their operations, which is great from a security perspective. But a lot of security people overlook that when they hear about immutable infrastructure. So I think part of the talk was born out of the fact that I hear tons of security people panicking about kind of microservices and other modern infrastructure, when really a much better use of their time. And what we tried to encourage in the talk is exploring how they can leverage this new infrastructure to enhance their security posture.
Okay. I mean, can you, that's awesome. Can you sort of like, how would day-to-day operations change? Like, could we sort of like walk through like a theoretical project of like, how is it done now? And what are some of the steps that would change, you know, in this other model? Like at what point does, you know, it go away from the, you know, the dev team and go into this sort of security SME model and then sort of kick back to them and so forth?
So admittedly, I'm still fleshing this out. Hopefully in a book form that will come out next year, knock on wood. But the idea is basically, so the status quo right now is often that developers like build a project, maybe they'll invite security to some sort of kind of really high level review before they actually build the thing. But most of the time, they've built it, they ask for a security review before it gets deployed. Security finds like all these vulnerabilities and prioritizes them for fixing. Sometimes it's going to be fixed by the product team itself. Sometimes it's just the security team. Oftentimes they'll argue over what's important or not, particularly if it's, you know, 1 week until release. They don't want to hold it back. And basically what we were proposing instead is that you have a security subject matter expert from the beginning that's sitting at the very conception of the project. They're sitting in on design, helping figure out, you know, poking holes in kind of the architecture, figuring out, for example, like the instance I gave, immutable infrastructure, or even like ephemeral systems. Like if you design the application to be stateless, you're actually removing quite a few vulnerability classes. So like, are you looking at things in that light? Are you thinking about attacker math? You know, what's the easiest path for the attacker to get to their goal? All these little things that can really materially improve the kind of inherent security that is created by the design. And having security sit in, you know, as prioritization decisions come up while it's being built, then obviously outlining these steps similar to kind of the unit testing that you see needed before deploying anyway, like figuring out what security tests need to be in place. So that way, by the end, security is not actually just the last minute gatekeeper. It's been
they're not being surprised by what they're seeing.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So it's really more of a partnership model, and it definitely involves rethinking the typical security organization and security team structure. But my personal take is that it's actually going to reduce a lot of headaches for security people. It does mean to get smarter on the system side and better understanding the products they're protecting, but it means that probably they're not going to be the ones fixing a bunch of stuff. They can kind of like sit back and just provide expert guidance.
Yeah. You're doing your sort of your work up front, and then you don't have, you know, sleepless nights at the very end there when we're trying to put the fires out.
Precisely.
Okay. So this was a phrase that I sort of hooked onto in one of your presentations. Can you tell me more a bit about the phrase chaos and resilience is InfoSec's future? What does that mean for cybersecurity professionals trying to break into the industry now or in terms of setting their own career strategies?
Yeah, so it's admittedly, I guess, a bit of a provocative phrase, though that wasn't my intention. So I think in the future, like I was just saying, InfoSec professionals really have to understand how systems, products, and the services that they're actually securing work. They have to have programming or some sort of kind of development experience, which definitely isn't true from kind of everything I've seen today. So I think it's much easier to find bugs in systems than to build secure systems from the ground up. It's something that a lot of the top kind of vulnerability researchers I know tend to agree with. So even though I'm not one myself, I feel comfortable stating that.
Yeah.
So again, being able to serve as a subject matter expert to the product team, helping them determine where security should be embedded from the design phase through to the actual delivery phase to end users, I think that's going to be invaluable. So that kind of blend of both programming and enough security expertise, I think, will be critical. And chaos and resilience in particular, I think part of resilience in particular, why I emphasize that is I think we need to start thinking of security as something that a system does rather than something that a system has. That's something I brought up in my hacktivity talk. And I think resilience is really about that. You can't just reach an end state of resilience. You can't just check really the box on resilience. It's kind of this ongoing ability for systems to be robust, but also adapt and transform as kind of the context of kind of the systems around them change. And so that's why I think resilience is really important, because it's not just about security and includes security, but it's also about performance. Mm-hmm. And the chaos side is really about, and this is true for resilience as well, it's about embracing that failure is inevitable. It's not only option, but it's very likely to happen.
Yes.
And I think this philosophy really changes how you think through problems. Instead of kind of attempting to establish perfect prevention, like, oh, we can stop all the threats, or creating like this Bible of policies that are trying to regulate, you know, all user behavior possible. I think instead you're moving towards, okay, how can we continually test our readiness? How can we ensure that, you know, we're responding appropriately so that it's, you know, maybe there's an outage for a few seconds, but we're recovering very gracefully, because that's ultimately what matters.
Okay. In terms of people who are sort of learning the trade and so forth, is this something where, you know, we can look at like studying different things, like learning more problem solving, or sort of putting your focus on certain other aspects of, you know, the art of security or whatever like that? Is you know, is there something we can sort of like take from this notion of chaos and resilience and apply to people who are just getting in on the ground floor?
Definitely. I think a big part of it. I'm obviously paying attention to tools like Chaos Monkey by Netflix, and there are a few others. Looking at chaos engineering as a discipline, I think will be invaluable. Okay. But I think also it's a lot of it, I think, is really about mindset. It's about thinking about the past to failure that you do know and how you can start injecting that in order to test it, which is where kind of the programming expertise comes in, which isn't always something required among people studying security. So I think, honestly, also looking to other disciplines, for example, resilience matters a lot when you're like building buildings, like how can it withstand an earthquake? You know, buildings are meant to shake a little bit, right?
Right.
So not confining yourself solely to tech, I think, is also good because there's a lot we can learn from other disciplines too.
That's awesome. So another interesting topic that I've seen you speak on, and you mentioned it briefly, and I want to get more into it, is the concept of cognitive biases behind security decision making. So what are some of the logical issues that people make in security strategy, you know, they're making incorrectly, and what are you prescribing as an alternative?
Yeah, so I would say, gosh, I could talk about this probably for the whole hour. Okay. To go through them all. I think, you know, one I've been trying to highlight a lot recently, because I've definitely gotten pushback on things like the black hat talk, where people are kind of set in their ways, which is status quo bias. So it's basically the way that we've always done it is the better way, just because it's the way we've always done it.
Yeah, it worked fine. Yeah.
Right. Sometimes there is evidence for that, but a lot of times there's not. So what's interesting is, empirically speaking, that deviating from the status quo can actually feel like some sort of loss to people. It feels like they're, you know, losing something. And I think that's very true for security from what I've seen. You know, if you've created some sort of policy, you've implemented a tool, it can almost feel like a failure when you move away from it. You know, like maybe my strategy wasn't good enough or something. And it definitely creates a lot of fear, even if it's the best course of action. So I think status quo bias definitely pervades a lot. Generally speaking, I think humans are bad at kind of evaluating options neutrally and quote unquote rationally. So we're more likely to gravitate towards what we already know because that helps it, be a little more comfortable. And in general, there's the concept of choice fatigue, where if we have too many choices, you know, it's kind of like those really extensive menus you sometimes see at diners. Like, I'm just like, oh my God, I have no idea what I could possibly get.
I don't want anything. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just easier to go with what we already know. I think there are a few ways to counter it. One, I think, is talking about value proposition is really important, but removing labels. So one could present a shift to like microservices or APIs as having the pros of like easier diagnostics. You're removing numerous vulnerability classes, removing the ability for attackers to like use automated attack tools sometimes, tangible best practices, and then things like standardization's benefits. Then monoliths, in contrast, maybe have a pro like, okay, it's a single resource, maybe it's easier to track. There is more direct control that the security team can have. But my guess is without labels attached, most security teams will be like, huh, this first one sounds a lot more interesting, even though if they hear the words microservices and API, they panic because they're like, oh my God, I don't really know what that means.
Okay.
So I think it's important to kind of look at the pros, cons, and try to remove, remove, I guess, the words that can cause a little trepidation among the team. But one thing that I've seen in some behavioral economics research is the idea of the reversal test, as well as the double reversal test.
Okay.
Which is basically the idea that you take, it's almost like taking it to its logical extreme. So let's say the security team currently disallows containers or something like that. And then someone proposes like, hey, developers should maybe use containers because it allows for greater standardization. You can do things like killing resources. It has the benefits of the immutable infrastructure I outlined earlier. So it's just easier to catch bugs and implement changes and respond to incidents more quickly. But if the security team pushes back, and this is definitely something I've heard them do, the question to ask is then, would less standardization be better? If the argument is, you know, pro-standardization, then you ask them kind of the reverse of that. It's like, okay, if you're against more standardization, then clearly you think maybe that we should have less standardization.
Right.
But they're probably going to argue that less standardization isn't better. So then you have to really needle them on like, okay, so why are we suddenly in this perfect sweet spot of standardization, right? Like something probably isn't right. And the double reversal test is just basically taking this even further, which can be kind of fun though. Obviously you can sound a bit like a jerk to a certain extent. So basically set up the scenario, like change is inevitable and you just have to go forward. And the idea is that would you intervene to go back to how things are today? So for example, like PCI, suddenly for compliance, you require it to move everything to a public cloud. Obviously that's going to be a headache for a lot of organizations, but let's say they do it over a few years, the security team has figured it out. But then a few years later, the PCI removes that, requirement to be able to meet compliance. So then the question is, should the organization migrate all of their stuff from the public cloud back to where it is today? My guess is most of the time, the security team will be like, no, that doesn't make sense. In which case, it's probably then status quo bias if they're resisting moving to it in the first place.
Interesting. Okay. So are there ways that these cognitive biases might affect strategy at different job levels from, you know, sort of security analyst up to CISO? Obviously we're talking about sort of management level things, but do sort of like, you know, people just monitoring, you know, vulnerabilities and things like that, are they sort of, you know, falling into the same traps of, I suppose with the status quo thing of like, this has always worked, I just got to go in and do my job and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think you definitely see it at different levels. So one thing I've seen with CISOs is it's not necessarily a kind of local status quo to the organization, but it's, they have notions of what's worked for them at other organizations. So obviously that's exactly what should be pursued at the new organization because they get to set the strategy. More at the kind of security engineer level, I do think it's more like, here's how I do my like practices. Here's how I think best practices work. Like, I think we should use this phone scanner. A lot of times it's more like the tools they're used to using just because they deal a lot with less with kind of the strategy level and it's more kind of the tactical level. So I would argue it like every human on earth kind of succumbs to status quo bias, unless, you know, it's a conscious effort to move away from it. So I think there are tons of different ways it manifests within security organizations.
Are there ways of sort of evangelizing this sort of breaking out of status quo bias if you're sort of in a lower level in the position and you sort of see your bosses being fine with, well, it worked last year, it will work again this year kind of thing?
That's a good question. I think it's going to depend on the organization and that comes down to more like culture because sometimes it's pretty frowned upon for, you know, more junior people to talk back to the manager level people. But I think the reversal test, like I mentioned, like if you are able to be in kind of brainstorming and strategy meetings, I think those are worthwhile ones to bring up and see how the group discusses it. And then maybe you can kind of gently point out like, okay, like, seems something's not right here. But it's going to be hard if you're not the one setting strategy, I think, to like put it this way, people tend not to like being reminded that they're succumbing to biases and that maybe they're thinking a little irrationally. So it's definitely, I would say, culturally tough to navigate.
Okay. So I want to sort of jump sideways here. I think we're probably going to be talking on some similar levels, but in your presentation at Hacktivity, which was titled "Errors Human, the Complexity of Security Failures," you talk about the concept of error as well as highlight and outcome biases constraining our thinking about security. Is this related in the sense of, we're trying to get away from the notion of humans are the biggest liability mindset that's sort of common in the industry in favor of, you know, errors are going to happen. So what do we do next? So I know there's a lot of, prescriptions and suggestions in the presentation, but can you give me an overview of some of the insights and recommendations and how this...
Yeah, definitely. I can. I have a ton of recommendations and obviously definitely recommend people check out the talk and hopefully the video will be available soon. Okay. But I'll definitely try to summarize briefly. So I think there are three key things and it's how I roughly structured the talk that you should do to get out of the kind of like humans bad sort of mindset. So the first is thinking in a systems perspective. Like I mentioned, thinking about security is something that a system does, not something a system has. So it means that you have to start anticipating failure and recognizing that it's going to stem from really the interrelation of components. Like no system is just like a linear set of components that like trigger each other one after another. It's kind of this spaghetti-ish mess and includes things like economic incentives and cultural norms in your organization. Again, really not the underlying components themselves. So you have to start thinking more in along the lines of like, okay, complex systems are these continually moving parts. Like we can't just blame one thing and call it a day. The second thing is prioritizing security UX, so user experience. I think you really have to start putting yourself in the shoes of your colleagues and starting to empathize with their workflows. You have to consider like the goals and constraints they have, because their job is just not to think about security 100% of the time. So the example I give in the Hacktivity talk is like an accountant. We've heard a lot about business email compromise. Like, you have to recognize that they probably have some sort of key performance indicator, like minimizing transaction time or something that kind of makes them have to hurry through their job. And so having some empathy with that can inform how you start designing your policies a bit better. And I think in general, you always need to be thinking about this when you design kind of policies, procedures, tests, like all of it. You have to ensure that the easy way is the secure way, because otherwise I don't think humans will do it. Most in any organization, like, I can't really think of many organizations where they're like, yeah, don't worry, like, just do this whenever, like, no pressure, like, it's normally under time constraints and we have some sort of outcomes we have to hit. So you have to be keeping this in mind and not just like imposing your rules as if security is the number one priority for everyone. And then the final thing is a blameless culture. So that doesn't mean absolving people of responsibility for their actions. That would be ridiculous, but it's really just making sure you're finding a balance between accountability and safety. So there's one concept I think is really important, which is asking neutral practitioner questions. So the idea here is that you take someone who's also an expert. Let's say you take another accountant and you give them kind of the context of the situation. Like, we had a client who is requesting, you know, $100,000 be sent to this bank account overseas, like, and you had a backlog of like 100 transactions to handle, blah, blah, blah. Just going through the context and asking them what they would have done in that situation. And that's a lot more likely to get to the truth than, us looking back and being like, well, clearly that accountant's stupid for not recognizing the scam.
Or telling him, like, why did you do this?
Exactly. So it really helps uncover like what those competing priorities and goals were. And that's, to me, the only way you can really inform security strategies, by understanding like what those constraints will be, so you can then counter them and help encourage like safer behavior. So yeah, it's systems perspective, security UX, blameless culture, really all of those in tandem help improve your resiliency a lot.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on that? There was that story down in Florida, was it a college or something got hit by ransomware, and, you know, the guy who, should have been, at the helm, got let go. I mean, did you feel like that was an appropriate response, or is that sort of fall into this where he did everything he could and they were just mad that the inevitable happened?
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely some mediocre people. I can't speak to like that guy in particular, but I think in general, like, firing the human is a very politically expedient thing to do. But like,
sounds like your board think that you're doing something.
Exactly. But like, are the conditions that led to it in the first place still there? Probably. Right. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I want to jump back to, there was a phrase that really jumped out at me. You said making it so that the easiest way is also the safest way. Do you have any sort of insights on that? I mean, that's such a like a clarifying sort of concept. I really like that, you know, because it's one thing to add yet another layer of things that you have to put into your, you know, Clockify report or whatever, but to make it so that like the thing that you're inevitably going to do anyway is also the thing that sort of keeps social engineering or phishing or other crazy things from getting through. Can you think of like any case studies of you know, how you would sort of implement this in a real world kind of way?
Yeah. So I gave some during the talk. The concept here is choice architecture, which is pretty well studied. So as an example outside of security, the classic one is that making 401k contributions default, like very few people actually opt out, which means that people are saving more, obviously not giving away or losing out on essentially free money. Mm-hmm. So the use of defaults can be really powerful. So for example, there are some companies that now just require, before you set up an account or can get access to it, you have to enable two-factor authentication. That's one way where you are adding a little bit of friction, but you're essentially inserting it into the account setup workflow, which generally feels less intrusive than going about it after the fact. Things like single sign-on are, I think, are a great example of a security tool that made the secure way the easy way. So most people are pretty terrible at managing all their accounts. So if you have one portal, through which like all of your colleagues and users can go, and you have two-factor on it. Like, it's more convenient for the user because they have all of their apps in one place, and then it's more secure for you because then you can manage all of the apps and credentials right. and stuff in one place.
I see.
So I think that's a great recent example of how both users and the security team can actually benefit if you think about security UX a little bit.
Okay. And I think once you sort of get that core concept into your head, there's probably all sorts of other places you can sort of apply it to your organization.
Definitely. The problem is, I would say overwhelmingly, security has not considered UX. I mean, I can't think of many talks at all at security conferences that have brought up the concept of UX. So,
okay. All right.
Yeah, I think it's just underexplored in our domain.
All right, get on it, everybody.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up today, what are some of your predictions for the big security and DevOps concerns that will emerge in 2020 and beyond? Do you think that these cognitive biases will be better understood and overcome in the future?
I sure hope so, but they certainly are still plenty rampant in other areas. I mean, even the kind of behavioral finance research I've seen, for example, like traders tend to perform worse on rainy days. Like, it's just humans have these weird brains, like, what can you do about it? But I definitely hope we see more behavioral economics, or maybe even neuroeconomics, given kind of the element in security of fear. I imagine there's some sort of stuff going on in like the amygdala or something that we could harness, but I think we definitely aren't there yet. But I think in general, like, it's good to better understand how we make our decisions in order to inform like how we can make better decisions, right? The primary challenge is, I think, and this assumes that people kind of accept my proposal that security shouldn't be in a silo, which is surprisingly controversial. It's become more embedded in DevOps. To me, it's really about culture and process. I think there will be some resistance among dev and ops. Like, they just naturally don't want to accept accountability for security stuff. They don't really understand how security works. They've probably had really bad experiences with their security teams in the past, even if not at their current company. On the InfoSec side, I can definitely tell you there's resistance about no longer being the gatekeeper and no longer being kind of like, you know, the sole arbiter of like control and allowing for releases and stuff. So I think there's definitely that cultural friction that's in place, but I think it was the same thing with DevOps and it worked out. So I definitely have hope for that. I still maintain like the idea of an embedded SME, which is something that it's a similar movement happening for database administrators. So we're not the only ones. The idea of an embedded SME on a product or feature team, I think makes the most sense for where the security organization goes today. But I do think it's a radical shift, so I'm not going to pretend like it'll be adopted overnight. But I know some companies that are starting to move towards that, and I'm hoping to see more kind of evolution along those lines. But I also think figuring out how to establish communication is going to be a tricky and definitely non-trivial endeavor. Because I don't think security is a very good communicator in general. Overcomplicate things a lot. And when I've had pretty great luck in explaining like security concepts to like dev and ops people, and they tend to get it. It's just, we have to slightly change our language and talk more in terms of risks that they're going to understand, like jeopardizing uptime, things like that. So my concern is really that people will overly focus as well on like technology, like DevSecOps sort of solutions, rather than putting in hard work on culture and process. And really stick to those buzzwords in trying to transform. But I think until you really establish this kind of unified collaborative culture with a strong communication flow, process integration, for example, integrating security tests along with your like unit tests, I really don't think you're going to see a lot of process. Like, tools just won't solve it. It'll just create even more silos. My hunch is actually that you'll streamline the number of tools you need. Because for example, like, if you need security telemetry to monitor like database access or something, probably your colleagues on the engineering side are already collecting that telemetry because they need it for performance monitoring. So I think actually if you start working together more, you can reduce the amount of spend and reduce the number of tools that you have just because you're starting to leverage the same telemetry and analysis and stuff like that. And I also think that if then we have DevOps more accountable for the security issues that they introduce, they're not going to tolerate the horrible UX of most security tools. it's, yeah, I think they're used to a much better user experience. And so I think most security companies are going to have to really step up their game if they want to still compete kind of in this new paradigm. That's obviously part of why I joined Capsule, because I think we can do that. But I think it's going to be a challenge for most security tools looking forward.
Okay, well, let's wrap up on that point. Let's talk a little bit about what Capsule does differently and how they throw their hat in the ring.
Yeah, definitely. So, like I said, Capsule's designed to be ops friendly and not risk production performance, but provide the visibility and protection people need. That includes whether on like containers, virtual machines, you have a data center, public cloud, whatever flavor of Linux systems you have, like we'll protect it, and we do so without like clogging networks, using a lot of resources and no kernel module, which that is like a death knell for any production system. So we have a lot of former black hats in house, which means that we're pretty good at catching black hats and providing multiple vantage points into the attack lifecycle. But again, we're constantly thinking about, okay, what does the ops team need and how can we help the security and ops team kind of work together on a unified strategy to keep production healthy?
Okay. First of all, I'm imagining the script, the movie script where you are finding these black hats sort of in flagrante and saying, all right, join our team.
Yeah, exactly.
So if people want to know more about Kelly Shortridge or Capsule 8, where can they go online?
Yeah, so my personal site is swagitda.com, S-W-A-G-I-T-D-A .com. That has all of my written and speaking content. Then Capsule8, it's capsule8.com. I definitely recommend checking out the work of our labs team, which has a bunch of deep dive technical content on things like Linux exploitation, which is pretty fun.
Awesome. Kelly, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, and thank you all for listening and watching. If you enjoyed today's video, you can find many more on our YouTube page. Just go to youtube.com and type in CyberWork with InfoSec to check out our collection of tutorials, interviews, and past webinars. If you'd rather have us in your ears during your workday, all of our videos are also available as audio podcasts. Just search CyberWork with InfoSec in your favorite podcast catcher of choice. To see the current promotional offers available to listeners of this podcast, go to infosecinstitute.com/podcast. And as we've mentioned before, election security is a big focus for us and going into 2020. So use our free election security training resources to educate poll workers and volunteers on the cybersecurity threats they might face during the election season. For more information about how to download your training packet, visit infosecinstitute.com/IQ/election-security-training or click the link in the description. Thank you once again to Kelly Shortridge, and thank you all for watching and listening. We'll speak to you next week.